Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
They say I'm disturbed.
From city to city, an incredible hysterical panic spread.
I think we're getting into a weird area here.
Will you tell these fools I'm not crazy?
This hysteria.
You can't handle the truth.
Brain is gone.
This is Hysteria 51.
We're here.
The truth is out there.
It's alive.
But you won't find it here.
They're coming for you. Look, there comes one of them now.
Welcome in, Hysteria Nation, to the podcast that doesn't always interview authors, but when we do, they have generally written about zombies. This is Hysteria 51.
You said that in the Max Brooks episode. Jeesh, now you're even recycling bad jokes.
It wasn't a joke. It's literally true. Max wrote about you know what? Never mind. You aren't going to derail this. Broadcasting from the lower fourth dimension, otherwise known as Chicago, my name is John Goforth, and the other actual sentient being here is Mr. Brent Hand.
Thanks, John. And I want to point out, not only sentient, but I don't require any external power sources. I mean, unless you count, Diet Mountain Dew and Snark. I do dabble in those quite often.
Speaking of cheese muffins. The funniest thing happened to me on the way to work today.
Is Kyle trying to do... Is he working out new material on us? What's going on here?
Stop me if you think you've heard this one before.
Well, I think he was, but now he's just quoting the Smiths.
Stop me, all of the hearts, stop me. Stop me if you think that you've heard this.
For some reason, C-Bot has that queued up because that's just our life.
It's actually an interesting story.
Nope, not today, Satan. I mean, C-Bot, that Freudian slip there. Today, we're going to get straight into our guest because it's an important one, it's a fun one, and they don't deserve to have to listen to the bullshit that is C-Bot or Kyle. Tell us about who we got on the show this week, John.
Kids, we are in for a treat tonight. Our guest today is a New York Times best-selling author, a 5-time Bram Stoker Award winner, a 3-time Scribe Award winner, an Inkpot Award winner. Oh, and also a comic book writer. And did I mention that his Vampire Apocalypse book series, V-Wars, is now a Netflix original series? He writes in multiple genres, including suspense and thriller and horror and science fiction and fantasy and action for adults, teens, and middle grade. Basically everything we do on this show, except for I don't know if we're acceptable for teens. other than that, his novels include the Joe Ledger thriller series, Bewilderness, Inc., Glimpse, the Pine Deep trilogy, the Rotten Ruin series, the Dead of Night series, which is a great, great zombie series, Mars One, Ghostwalkers, a Deadlands novel, and many others. He's the editor of many anthologies, including The X-Files, Aliens Bug Hunt, Don't Turn Out the Lights, Knights of the Living Dead, and others. His comics include Black Panther, Doom War, Captain America, Pandemica, Highway to Hell, The Punisher, and Bad Blood. Oh, and he's also a board member of the Horror Writers Association and the president of the International Association of Media Tie-In Writers. Kids, welcome to the show, one of my favorite authors, and hopefully one of yours too, Mr. Jonathan Mayberry. Jonathan, welcome.
Well, thank you, and I'm exhausted after all that.
Man,
have a beer.
I need Holy to crap. Pull out my resume and light it on fire. Dear Lord.
Well, half of that is complete lies anyway, so, you know, we're good.
Well, you've got a good publicist then. Yes. in all seriousness, we definitely have, we've talked about your work before on this show, and we're thrilled to have you.
John talks about your work all the time. He's a huge fan.
And slip $5 every now and then.
Exactly.
yeah, I trust the check is in the mail. But before we're going to talk, you have a brand new book out, Relentless. It's the latest in the Joe Ledger series. But before we get to it, I want to start with a little background. There's some stuff in your background that I just read on your Wikipedia page that I didn't know about. I didn't even realize in your background some things. So to borrow a turn of phrase from the comic book world, what's your origin story? How did you get into writing? What drew you to horror, sci-fi, all that good stuff?
Yeah, where'd that vat of toxic chemicals come from is what I'm getting at.
I was bitten by a radioactive writer, and you know. I was one of those people that I've always wanted to write. I cannot remember any point in my life where I didn't want to tell stories, even before I could read and write. So I would use my old G.I. Joes, and when I was a kid, G.I. Joe was a 12-inch tall action figure. I would use him and my sister's Barbies, and got stuffed, you know, King Kongs, and I would create stories that way. So I was always into writing. In high school, though, I began focusing more on nonfiction. I wanted to become the next investigative reporter because a couple of years after the Watergate thing, I wanted to be both Woodward and Bernstein. I wanted to break that story, be the guy. And I went to college on a journalism scholarship. But halfway through, I got into the idea of magazine writing, and I wound up doing that off and on for decades after that. I didn't even consider fiction until the early 2000s. And wow. That came about because I was, it's weird. I was writing I'd done a series of nonfiction books on martial arts for a small publisher in Pennsylvania. And there was an open book in the contract. We had not decided what it was going to be. And I never promised it would be martial arts. So for the hell of it, I wrote a book on the folklore of supernatural predators around the world and throughout history, called Vampire Slayer's Field Guide to the Undead. Mm-hmm. And my publisher was so afraid that my martial arts readers would think I'd had a neurological accident that he made me write it under a pen name. But the research for that made me want to write fiction, and I did that. But before I did my novels, and before writing novels turned me into a full-time writer, my day job was not writing. My day job was a bodyguard in the entertainment industry. I was a bouncer in a strip club, for God's sake. That's a really horrible job if you like human beings, because you get that at the end of that. And then I taught women's self-defense at Temple University and also martial arts history at Temple University for 14 years. So my income-generating career was all about martial arts. I'm an eighth-degree black belt retired jiu-jitsu master. And I did that to pay the bills. It wasn't until I switched to fiction that fiction wound up being the thing that paid all the bills and made me a full-time writer.
That's I grew up in the 80s, and I loved the Chuck Norris, Ernie Reyes. I was telling John before we were starting, I watched Sidekicks last night with Chuck Norris and Jonathan Brandis. So that's, I mean, and you're actually in the Martial Arts Hall of Fame, correct?
Yeah, I'm in kind of two of them. One is called the Action Karate International Martial Arts Hall of Fame, which I get in 2003, I think. And then in 2004, I was inducted into the World Head of Family Sokyship Council, which is a group that is composed of the heads of different styles of martial arts around the world. And the reason I am the head of my style for North America is because everyone else died. I just basically outlived the other guys. You know, it's not like I was, you know, martial arts, you know, superhero. It's just that, you know, after a certain point in martial arts, you stop testing, and if you're still breathing, they'll give you another rank.
Well, it's like they say, you know, you don't have to be the fastest gazelle. You just can't be the slowest.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
That's pretty much it.
You said retired. Brent, I think Brent was going to ask if you still practice.
I do. I mostly focus on sword work and, you know, weapons work, because between bodyguard work, women teaching women self-defense, and being a bouncer, there's a lot of my joints that are not original packaging. Screws, pin, darting. So I'm not going to be doing the falls and the rolls and stuff anymore. Right. I did 50, you know, this is my 58th year in martial arts. I'm done with all that stuff. And I don't have the time to teach. So I take my katana, which is, you know, I've been studying and practicing and teaching kenjutsu, Japanese martial arts, Japanese swordplay, almost as long as I've been doing jiu-jitsu. I take that and a couple Chinese swords. And so I'm going to the woods. I live in Southern California, so there's always a canyon I can go into. And I do my solo kata, or I do it on the bluffs over the beach. And, you know, it's just me and that part of martial arts where you no longer train to fight.
Hola, David. Me amo Brent.
Bonjour, Brent. Je m'appelle David.
You didn't do Spanish. I thought if we were going to do this together, we'd do the same language.
Oh, sorry.
that's on brand for us.
I just thought romance languages was the key.
Everything I say is romantic, and that is thanks to Rosetta Stone. You guys, we've been touting these things forever. We love Rosetta Stone, and we actually are users. David, you've really been using it even for longer than I. What's your experience been like?
Oh, it's been great. The thing is, you really get to learn how to speak and think in that language with it. So it's very high on pronunciation too. So you can, you know, learn how to speak.
And you know, our show is all about proper pronunciation.
In that pronunciation. Yeah, that's right. But they designed it for long-term retention, you know. If you don't get the pronunciation right, you say it until you do. And then, you know, that just seeps into your head.
Well, and that's why, you know, this has been trusted by experts for 30 years. And there's over 25 different languages that you can learn. And people, millions and millions of users use it because, like you said, it does seep in and you're using it with, you know, you get speech recognition and mm-hmm. it hears you. You get to use like the built-in true accent features that gives you this pronunciation, which is super convenient. And you can do it at your own time. And I don't know if you know this, but I'm all about value. And you get a one-time purchase, 25 languages. If I learned all 25 languages, I'd be so confused or really cool. I'd go in and out.
But you'd be real marketable.
But literally, though, this is something that we use. And we have both of us have given the seal of approval because we want to do this long term. And it's something that it works. You know, and we don't do long-term stuff like this. And this is the one that we've chosen and we love it. So all you guys got to do, don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now, as we've told you 1,000 times. And it's always now, right now. Get started. For very limited time, Hysteria 51 listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off.
How much?
50%. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your unnatural life.
Wow.
Redeem, redeem, redeem. How do they do it?
Rachete, you're 50% off. Rachete. Redeem it. 50% off. rosettastone.com/today. Do it today. After years of fine print contracts and getting ripped off by overpriced wireless providers, if we've learned anything, it's that there's always a catch. So when Brent and I heard that for a limited time, all Mint Mobile wireless plans are $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan, we thought, man, what's the catch? But after talking to them, it all made sense. There isn't one. Mint Mobile's secret sauce is that they sell wireless service online. They cut out the cost of retail stores and pass those sweet savings directly to you. Brent is trying a plan right now and says that it works like a charm from Chicago to Nashville as he makes his big old move. Mint Mobile is working for him. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. And you can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all your existing contacts. So ditch the overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's limited time deal and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/hysteria. That's mintmobile, mintmobile.com/hysteria, hysteria. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/hysteria. $45 upfront payment required. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
A physical enemy you train to fight your own limitations. And that makes it a much more meditative.
That's awesome. Probably much more, you know, beneficial to you at this age. Like, well, like you said, you know, your body falls apart. You know, hell, I'm going through that right now. You know, you get in your 40s, you wake up. I slept wrong last night, and I almost didn't walk to the bathroom for like 30 minutes. I just sat there. So,
No. one of the things about martial arts is, especially when we were doing it back in the 60s and 70s, it's way before sports medicine was a thing. And we didn't realize how much damage we were doing because at the time we felt like Superman. You know, I could run across the room with my hands and bench press 410 pounds. And, you know, I felt like Superman. And then now in my 60s, I'll wake up with some body part sending me hate mail or filing a lawsuit against me because of the abuse. And I have to deal with it now. And I wish I could go back and smack the crap out of that younger man who kept doing all that weird shit.
Yeah, they don't show that in like the Expendables movies where they all wake up and they reach for the ibuprofen or the Aleve or things like that.
Yeah, there are mornings you wake up and you're lucky if you can turn on your side, let alone reach for something on a table.
It's funny. I actually box for my workouts. I've had for about a decade now, and my boxing trainer is a former professional Muay Thai fighter, and he introduced me to the wonders of Naaman oil. I don't know if you've ever heard. Is this, Naaman is the brand. It's made in Thailand, and I have no idea what magic they put in it, but you put it on whatever muscles hurt after you get done with a round, and it gets really hot, and it magically makes it feel a whole lot better.
it's similar. It's similar in chemistry to Tiger Balm and a few other things that I've used by the gallon over the years.
Yeah.
And now instead of fighting, I love writing fight scenes in my books, and I teach writing fight scenes. In fact, Saturday I'm teaching a 3-hour workshop on how to write fight and action scenes and understand the difference between the different styles of martial arts and self-defense and so on, which is important for writers so they get the information correct.
Well, you put the ball in the tee for me because I was going to ask that question as it relates to your writing when it comes to, you know, the fight scenes, especially the one-on-one fight scenes. Specifically, I'm thinking of like Joe Ledger fighting, you know, the big bad, whoever the big bad in that particular novel is. They're so detailed. I can picture them. And the way I picture them, they very much feel the way that. Do you remember the first time you saw some of the Japanese cinema kind of translate over into American fight scenes? It went from those bad 80s American fight scenes to things like that Jet Li did. Yeah. And your ability to translate that to the page is kind of like, was that kind of revolutionary moment for me of like, I can literally picture each of these movements as opposed to they punched and kicked for a while and rolled around on the ground.
Yeah, and then one of the things there is, and I'm not to slight anyone else who writes fight scenes, because there are a lot of people who write good ones, but it shows when you know what you're doing, and it shows when you don't.
I was just going to say, you can probably see through the bad immediately, you know, or the Liam Neeson cut takes in 1,000 cuts to make a fight scene come together, not to throw shade.
Yeah, but, you know. And unfortunately, there's a lot of misinformation and disinformation out there. Like, for example, it's popularly believed that you can strike the base of the nose and drive the nose bone into the brain, which, you know, Stephen King put in Firestarter and Shirley Conrad put in Savages and it's been in other books. It's physiologically impossible, but it got into the culture as a belief. Like they used to believe back in the 70s and 80s and even into the 90s that a black belt had to have their hands registered with the police. That's never been done anywhere in the world. And yet, there are martial arts schools that charge your students for that registration.
That was just in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, where he's like, everyone, if anyone kills someone in a fight, they go to jail. It's called manslaughter.
Yeah, but that's not actually true. I mean, you know, there are provisions for self-defense, and a lot of it depends on witnesses.
Right, that was
the lack of.
Of course.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, Jonathan, you've written all these books, and we're going to get into a few of them in a moment. But you've also been a writer for some of our favorite comic titles as well. Obviously, you kind of gave us a background on how you started in the books, but how did you get into comics? And I'd love to hear about your approach, because I'm assuming that it's a much different endeavor, and how you approach one versus the other, and whether you have a preference.
Well, as far as how I got into it, my agent and I had been trying to figure out how to get into it. We had been strategizing because I was a Marvel kid growing up. I love Marvel comics, right? And I wanted to write for Marvel, but we didn't know anyone at Marvel. And we were, you know, literally days away from doing a cold pitch to Marvel when I got a phone call out of the blue from Axel Alonso, editor-in-chief of Marvel. He had been in L.A., was about to fly back to New York, didn't have his Kindle with him. So he grabbed a book off the stand at the bookseller, and it was Patient Zero, my first Joe Ledger. Wow. And he read it on the plane. He, you know, got my phone number, and said, you know, called me and said, "Look, I love the dialogue, I love your action, and I love your sense of humor. Any chance I could talk you into maybe writing something for Marvel?" And you know, that is, by the way, a silly question. You know, do you think you might want to write for Marvel? Geez, let me go out and think about that for a while. And he, you know, he said, "Here's what I would like you to do. Your audition will be an 8-page Wolverine short, self-contained Wolverine story. You know, give me that first." I sent it to him. I didn't actually think it was going to be published. I thought it was just an audition piece. Turns out they were looking for an 8-page short as the backup piece for one of the Wolverine yearly annuals.
Oh, cool.
And so it wound up being there with incredible art by Tom Coker. It's amazing. A piece called Ghosts. And then on the strength of that, he asked me to write a Punisher Max story. Now, it had been some years since I'd read comics, and I thought Punisher Max was the name of a character. As it turns out, it is the hard R-rated...
Yeah, the adult. Line
of comics. And he told me to go over the top. I went over the top, and he told me to tone it down. And I toned it. The version that came out seems over the top. It's actually the toned down version. And from there, he just kept feeding me other projects and asked me what I wanted to do. One of the best moments within Marvel, though, I had been interviewed, you know, as a new writer for Marvel, I'd been interviewed by a lot of print and radio and so on reporters. And on one of the interviews, I was talking about my childhood. I grew up in a very racist neighborhood. My father was in the KKK. He was a bad guy. And I only had that viewpoint about Black people until I encountered the character of T'Challa in the pages of Fantastic Four magazine. And, you know, he was everything my father said a Black person couldn't be. Successful, powerful, honorable, you know, all those things. And I couldn't very well ask him about it. So in seventh grade, I took one of those comics to my school librarian and asked her. And then she explained about apartheid and the Jim Crow laws and history of racism in America. And it was a completely different story than I'd ever heard. Well, that changed my life completely. And Reginald Hudlin, the founder of BET Network, was writing Black Panther at the time. And they had me do a little work on his book when he was on schedule conflicts, just doing dialogue, some dialogue stuff. And he said, you know, that interview with Mayberry about how T'Challa pretty much saved his life. I think when I step down, I'd like him to take over the book.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And that was, first off, Marvel was moving toward having only Black writers write Black Panther, which, by the way, I actually endorse. And it's what they're doing exclusive now, which I think is a smart idea. But the opportunity came up, and it was, you know, that comic character was the most influential in my entire life. So getting an opportunity to write the book was great. And then Reggie threw me another little gift. As he was stepping down, he had T'Challa get injured. So Shuri had to step up to be the Panther. And he did that because he knew I had been teaching women self-defense my whole life. So he allowed me to write the feminist Black Panther comic for 2 years.
That's awesome.
That was just incredibly awesome.
So obviously very different endeavors. Do you approach them the same way, or do you, you're creating from nothing, you know, Joe Ledger came from your mind. Yeah. The other, you're already, you're in someone else's world, or at least it's kind of like the improv thing. Yes. And you have to accept everything that happened before and then build upon it. How does that approach differ?
It's significantly different because a novel is a solo thing. You know, it's you for however many months it takes you to write the novel. It's you in your own head. And then once it's complete, you send it off to your editor and you get notes. But with comics, it's very much a team. The editor in comics is much more hands-on on all stages of it than a novel editor is. Plus, you have the artist, and sometimes you have a penciler and an inker and a colorist. Mm-hmm. So you have an art team and you have a letterer, all of whom have input into the process, because however much the script may be the foundation of the comic, it's the visuals that make people pull it off the shelf.
Yeah, it's more like it's got a movie or a film vibe to it almost. And so you're going through all those. There's a lot more, you know, cooks in the kitchen, so to speak.
Yeah, more people can tell you who starred in the movie, who directed it, than who wrote the script.
Yeah.
And the same with comics. But, you know, and even though we write, you know, we writers tell you how many panels and what art goes in each panel, it's the artist's job to reinterpret it. And often the artist will have notes that will, you know, suggest a different visual way of telling that story, that if you're a good writer and you don't have your head up your ass, you listen, because this artist is bringing his A game. Another artist and somebody else is bringing their A game. It's a team of people doing their top work. And the end result should reflect all of that skill, all of those different viewpoints. And I learned early on to listen to the art team. So it is very, very collaborative. And as such, it creates a kind of a more fun environment at times, because all the emails going back and forth, sometimes team emails, and sometimes like the artist will say, hey, look, I just wanted to go over this before I gave it to the editor. What do you think of this? I'm like, oh, man, that's badass. And then sometimes you also run into some issues, you know, which luckily are caught in the process. Some of the artists are in different countries. So in one scene, I had the Punisher throwing a bunch of grenades. And in the art direction, I wrote, you see the grenades, the spoons and the pins flying through the air, right? Well, the Croatian artist didn't realize that the spoon and pin were parts of the grenade. The pin is the grenade you pull out, the spoon is the army. Oh, God. So the picture that came back was soup spoons, safety pins, and grenades flying through the air. So we had time to fix that, and we all had a good laugh about it.
You know what? Leave it. I love it.
We'll call it shrapnel. Yeah. We'll call it shrapnel. So, okay. All right. Let's cut to it. Let's get to it. On
now,
to
hold
Joe
on.
Ledger.
We're talking about spoons, and I'm fat, so I'm enjoying this line of talking. Let's keep going. No, I'm
Jonathan, it's how I became familiar with your work. I discovered Patient Zero. I mean, it has to have been a decade ago.
It was 12 years ago.
Wow. Okay. So yeah, there weren't any other books out in the series when I found Patient Zero, and I've been following along ever since. For our listeners who haven't yet picked up one, shame on you, but also, how would you describe the series? What's your sort of elevator pitch for the Joe Ledger series?
Well, Joe Ledger is a retired cop, or was a former cop, former soldier, Army Ranger, who was recruited by an organization that recognized his unique set of skills. He is a very good martial artist, and he does not hesitate, which is a rare thing. And they hire him. The organization that hires him is tasked with going up against terrorists with weird science weapons, cutting-edge science weapons. And in each book, the science is different. The first one is a prion disease retasked to create a zombie-like plague. And the last team that went up against them hesitated because it was people they knew who had been converted into the zombies. That hesitation became fatal. They needed someone who wasn't going to hesitate, and that was Joe. And he demonstrated that he was just that level of fighter. There are some people who are at that level. Each subsequent book has a different type of science, transgenic science, weaponized rabies, drones, all sorts of stuff. And most of the science is pretty close to the real world, like 9/10 true. And then, you know, we step off into the fantasy.
Well, and let me ask you a question kind of building on that.
Yeah.
That's one of the things I've always noticed about the series. There's no magic per se. The zombies come from, as you said, a prion disease.
That's how you sold me on it, John. As you said, it's all these crazy monsters, but it's real world science and things like that, that it's not just, and then something started glowing and everyone turned into
It didn't just come from the depths. The monster didn't just come from the depths of the sea. It was bioengineered. There's lots of examples of it. You've also done a lot of other writing projects where there, you know, supernatural things are involved, but specifically in the Joe Ledger world, explain to us the kind of the decision to make the supernatural natural, or rather the real world explanations for what could be construed as supernatural, whether it be zombies or monsters or whatever.
Well, I blame my grandmother for this. probably not where you thought I was going to go. So my grandmother, if you can imagine the character Luna Lovegood from Harry Potter as an old lady, she believed in everything, absolutely everything. But at the same time, and when I was a kid, she filled my head with all these folk tales of you know, everything from church Grimms to hanky punks to red caps, you know, the whole bit. And but at the same time, she encouraged me to read the archaeology, the anthropology, and the science scholarship on the subject, because she said that there's a reason people believe in things. And now she did believe in supernatural, but she believed that the supernatural was an aspect of science. We are not yet at the point that we can measure it and quantify it. And she believed that a lot of what we consider to be, you know, supernatural creatures like fairies and so on are beings from other dimensions rather than supernatural dimensions.
Well, that's something that's gotten in the world that we're in. People have been latching onto that for the last few years. That's been a thing they've talked about quite a bit.
Exactly. And it's a little more reasonable to start that conversation with skeptics than saying vampires, you know.
Yeah. Magic. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And she, you know, I went up the book that was my gateway from nonfiction to fiction was in fact a book, you know, The Vampire Slayer's Field Guide to the Undead, written under the pen name of Shane McDougall, was all about those types of creatures. And I was fascinated by the different types of monsters out there, the different things that people believed. And I found by studying a lot of the commentary by scientists over the years and sociologists and so on, that there's often a valid scientific theory behind it. And I'll give you a great example. So for years, people believed that there was some sort of an evil, invisible spirit that would come into a child's bedroom at night and suck out its breath and leave it dead, right? Now, people, and that happens all over the world, and there were no explanations for it. But if you look at sudden infant death syndrome, where a healthy child is put to sleep, there is no visible marks on the body, but the child dies, right? So for the people who this happened to centuries ago, they would go to the only authority figure in town, which is the local priest or preacher. That person would have them pray or do some acts of contrition, maybe give them some holy objects to put in their house. And since SIDS very rarely happens to the same family twice, the prayers that they're doing seem to work because the family is then protected because, again, it doesn't happen again. So it balances their worldview because it allows them to believe that God is, in fact, up there somewhere, and that if you do the right things church-wise, you're protected, and that whatever did that is not God, not God arbitrarily killing your child or allowing it to happen, but an anti-God, a monster. So right. It actually, the belief in monsters allowed people to believe more strongly in their whatever deity was in their religion. But from a scientific viewpoint, we can now see, you know, the cause and effect that led them to that belief. And there are a lot of these in the world. The other one I want to mention real quick is there are transcripts from werewolf trials throughout Italy, Germany, France, going back centuries. If you can get translations of them, which folklore departments have, I read them at the University of Pennsylvania folklore department, the trials for these people, most often the person did not actually turn into a wolf. They turn into someone acting bestial, clever, somebody maybe who fed on their you know, victims. It's basically their way of understanding serial killers. I've always read both sides of it, the supernatural, which I love for entertainment, and the scientific, which makes the world fit better on its wheels. And when I started writing the Joe Ledger series, I wanted to stay in the realm of plausible. Now, I do step over the line a couple of times. In Extinction Machine, it's UFOs. So, you know, maybe there are UFOs. In Killswitch, he encounters Cthulhu. And that happened by accident, by the way. So my editor for the Joe Ledger series comes out to San Diego Comic-Con. I live in San Diego every year. And we walk around and we talk. And he always asks me, what's the next Ledger book? And as a joke, just as a joke, I said, off the top of my head, Joe Ledger versus Cthulhu. No intention of it ever being an actual story. He turns to me and goes, that's awesome. Let's do that. And I'm like, oh, shit.
I got to do it.
South Park can do it. By God, so can I.
So I did. And but mostly with the Joe Ledger book, we stay pretty grounded in science. And there is a little bit of supernatural in there. The Nicodemus character.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to get to in a moment. I'm going to put you on the spot with that in a second, but I want to stay in this vein for just one second.
Sure.
So to give you a backstory, a while back we were talking about our favorite book series, and Brent mentioned one of his favorites, He reads a ton of the Jack Reacher novels from
childhood.
And I basically said, I'd read a couple and I said, well, that's sort of, I mean, obviously there's a lot of differences, but that's sort of Joe Ledger, you know, one man is the protagonist and has people around him in each book that help him. And, you know, there's a big bad and, it, you know, it kind of the through line is that character. Only in the Ledger series is with Fordian topics. And by the way, Joe would take out Jack Reacher in a fight, in my opinion.
Anyway, my dad could beat up your dad.
that is all to ask. Yeah, what is the driving force of the Ledger series? Is it wanting to attack the Fordian topics, or is it more the super spy army ranger side that it's just fun to like? Which one is the driving force behind the series?
It's the nonfiction topics, the science that I get to research. I'm a science junkie, and the collision of weird science and weird beliefs. Those are the driving forces. The characters. I mean, Joe Ledger is a great character. I love him. But if I wasn't writing any more Joe Ledger books, I'd still write books with those types of topics.
Right.
And I did that with the Dead of Night and Fall of Night series, my zombie series, because I did more research to create that version of the zombie plague, which was parasite driven, than any book I'd ever researched. And we got to the point where my epidemiologist and parasitologist friends got me to 70% doable with the zombie plague in that book. Luckily, the other 30% is not doable.
That's what I say. I don't know if we want to get much closer than that.
I was hoping we'd get to at least 20%, and they got me to 70. I'm like, oh, please stop.
I'm frightened at this point.
Yeah.
Another great series. That's the other series of yours that I read every inch of. So sticking along those lines of the supernatural and Joe Ledger, one of the primary protagonists outside of Joe is Ledger's boss, Mr. Church. Mm-hmm. Probably my favorite character in the series. He's been described by various characters in the book as everything from just a tough son of a bitch to the devil himself. And generally that's by the bad guys he's going after. But my question is, are there plans to give us a little bit more on him, his origin? You've alluded to a past with a certain vampire, Nicodemus. If anyone's read the series, they have to be interested in Mr. Church.
Yeah. Well, first off, Nicodemus is not a vampire. He is a trickster. So he's more of an elemental spirit. Mr. Church is human. He's not supernatural in any way. He's just remarkably old.
There's always allusions to there being more behind the screen.
There is. He's considerably older than he looks for a reason. Okay. But he's based on an actual person. And right now we have 30, what's the latest count? Hold on. 35, 36 people who have figured out who Mr. Church is.
Oh, wow.
Oh, okay. Okay, so this is an Easter egg of sorts.
Yes, the book Rage has the most obvious clues, and it is not Vlad Dracul, as some people thought.
Got it.
He was not a vampire. He was not Vlad the Impaler. But Rage has the strongest clues, and since that book came out, more people have guessed. I'm not planning to write an origin story for Mr. Church.
Got it. So I'm going to have to go back to Rage again. And despite the very sad ending, I won't ruin it for anyone who hasn't read it. Despite the very sad ending, I'm going to go read it again and see if I can pick up on those clues.
You'd be so embarrassed when you send him like 19 different names and he's like, nope, no, please stop.
Nope.
Please.
Nope.
I'll even give you a hint.
Please.
The chapters dealing with the establishment of the new base and Mr. Church's apartment suite have the clues that you're looking for.
Oh, okay. Okay. I know exactly what you're talking about. So let's hit on that real quick. If people are readers of the Ledger series for the first, I don't know how many books it was, nine, something like that. It was, they had the original team, the Department of Military Science, mm-hmm. which has now closed and moved into Rogue Team International. Is that right?
Yeah. I did 10 books for the Department of Military Sciences.
10.
And
okay.
Then I switched. We wanted a couple of reasons I wanted to switch. One, I couldn't imagine Mr. Church working comfortably with the administration at the time.
I told Brent that. I said, listen, we're not a political podcast. We don't get into politics. I said in reading the books, you can kind of read between the lines, and there's some allusions that perhaps not political, not Republican or Democrat, just that particular nationalistic type of approach wasn't Mayberry's favorite.
No, I detect, like, my politics are very similar to Joe's. I'm mostly apolitical. I'm a humanist. So I'll land on whatever is best for people and not for political parties. And when political parties become more important than the people they're representing, I'm out. And that's Church. That's Joe.
The world I'm living in.
Yeah. And I lost some fans, you know, some readers who didn't like the fact that an author put politics into a book. And I'm thinking, have you read books? Like, going back to freaking Gilgamesh, there's been politics in books. You know, so open your eyes a little bit.
But it's hard to talk about the human experience and not address it in some way, shape,
or form. But the other reasons I had them form Rogue Team International is, you know, I've done a lot of traveling around the world. I love other cultures. I like the idea of them solving problems elsewhere. And they do, you know, Relentless actually ends with them back on U.S. turf for the last third of the book. So, you know, it's not like I'm leaving behind my own country.
Sure.
And also, I like that they get to pick their own fights as opposed to being someone else's bulldog. And it became a good jumping on point for new readers. So there's a lot of reasons we did that. And it's been satisfying in all those ways.
Wonderful, wonderful. Loving the new direction. Let's take a quick break, if you don't mind, Jonathan, and we'll come right back right after this with some more questions and some more time with Jonathan Mayberry.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Nation, we are back, and we took our break. We grabbed that beer we were talking about, went to the restroom, and we're ready to talk.
John
more
begged
writing.
Him and begged him to tell him who Mr. Church really was, and he told him no, and threatened to leave the
it
show.
It got ugly.
And it was weird.
There were tears.
There were restraining orders involved. Let's not get into it. But we're continuing down the line of how you write. One of the things I love to your approach specifically with the Ledger novels, I'm going to butcher the terminology here because I'm not a writer, but the regular chapters or the chapters that aren't from Ledger's perspective are written just sort of normally. But from Ledger's perspective, you get his interior monologue, what's going through his mind.
Yeah.
And you know, what's the thinking behind that? What drove that stylistically? What makes you give us that view in versus the kind of more normal, just you're never inside of anyone's head?
Well, first, when Joe Ledger was born in my head, he was born talking in first person narrative. This is the kind of thing with writers. I was at a diner in Philadelphia. I used to live in Philly, working on a nonfiction book about zombies called Zombie CSU. And while I was working on that book, two characters started talking in my head. If you are not a writer, this is a serious cry for help. If you are a writer, it's another day on the job. And, you know, there was somebody telling me a story about him being interviewed by this really odd, you know, executive military type. And it was the conversation when Joe first met Mr. Church. But I didn't know that. I didn't even know their names at that point. But the conversation happened. And I, you know, after it playing in the back of my head, I stopped doing what I was doing. I started writing it down, took agency over it. And, you know, Joe Ledger was born. And he's a smart ass who had to be good at his job and was emotionally compromised up the wazoo. I think the precise diagnosis is crazy as a bag of hamsters. and I don't mean to go clinical on you, but, you know, I think that's what they call it.
Write that down.
Yeah. And I told my agent about it. And I said, I have a book idea. I thought it was going to be a one shot. I wrote some pages. She took it. She shopped it, got a deal. And when they bought the deal, they said, okay, we're going to buy this. And the next two in the series, what are they about?
Ah, crap.
Yeah. And this was on a phone call. So I'm like, well, and so I just made up two plots on the spot.
It's like that old Saturday Night Live with Dana Carvey. He's thinking up songs. And they're like, hey, you had a hit. What are your next ones?
Yeah, it's that sort of thing. And it happens a lot in publishing, by the way. They always assume you have more books in that series. And I could definitely get behind that. So I told them some ideas. They became books two and three. Actually became books two and four. The novel, the idea I originally had for book three, I was talked out of writing by somebody at Homeland Security. I have a friend who's at Homeland, and he reviewed my political plots. And he said, he was part of a group that brought in counterterrorism teams from around the world to do training. And something I ended up writing about in King of Plagues. And they ran my scenario on one of their counterterrorism weekends, and they couldn't beat it. The best they can get is 40% kill of the U.S. population. and this is not...
maybe not write this? Thanks.
Well, they leased it from me for 99 years. They paid me really well. Thank you for your tax dollars. And they had me sign a scary non-disclosure agreement. So I'm never going to write that story. But I took the idea of the counterterrorism teams and all that, and that part I put into King of Plagues.
So now you know there's think tanks sitting around looking into your past, wondering where he come up with this stuff, and you're on like six or seven new lists because of that.
But I'm also involved in at least one government think tank now.
Well, there you go.
Oh, cool. Cool.
Just to monitor you.
I get the feeling I'm going to have a lot more success getting out of you who Mr. Church is meant to be than I am the plot of that book. So we'll move on. You know, one of the things you just touched on, crazier than a bag of hamsters, that's one of the things that you really focus on in every novel. It's the various aspects of Ledger's fragmented psyche. I believe you refer to him as the cop, the killer, and the civilized man.
Yeah.
And then you kind of communicate to us who's in control when various things happen. And Joe talks through it. And, you know, if one is getting too strong, it's always the worry the killer's going to take over. But I'd love to know what about the psychology of heroes has you continue to return to that theme over and over again?
Well, remember, I grew up during the Vietnam era, and I saw so many people come back from Vietnam, including my brother, who did several tours over there, come back different and damaged. He had signed up with all of his buddies to serve together. And they were promised they would be auto mechanics, because that's what they did before they went in. They made them combat engineers, sent them right to Vietnam, and had them, they would drop defoliant, put them in an advanced area, have them build helicopter bases. He was the only one that came back. So he kept re-upping, hoping that he would find them, because he was damaged goods. And I saw that time and time again. I grew up in a very blue-collar neighborhood. Everybody's sons, the ones who didn't die, were coming home damaged. And all of our fathers were from World War II or Korean War, and we saw the damage they had. So, you know, there is a saying that violence always leaves a mark. And as a martial artist, somebody who's been involved in hundreds of fights as a bodyguard and a bouncer, I know this left marks on me. I mean, not just the physical scars I have, but the emotional ones. I can feel some of the fights I've been in that you always wonder, did I do too much? Did I do enough? You know, what do people think who saw me doing that? You know, I've even talked to some of the people I protected, and they were as horrified by what I did as they were by what the person was trying to do to them. Hmm. So given all that, And given that my martial arts instructor and all of his assistant instructors were just back from Vietnam, I PTSD was a very real thing even before that acronym was well known. And I had read a brilliant novel by a guy who became a good friend of mine, David Morrell. He wrote a novel called First Blood, which was the first Rambo film. Now, if you read the novel, you know, Rambo dies at the end. It's a tragedy about PTSD, the first novel about PTSD under that label. And it was very powerful, very affecting. The movie did not do it justice, you know. And I knew that when I wanted to write about somebody heroic, I didn't want to write about a spotless hero who had no flaws, no vulnerabilities. I wanted to write about somebody who, despite their flaws and vulnerabilities, was able to stand up. Yeah. And there's that saying, and I it's in the book, and I cannot remember whose quote it was. It's in Patient Zero. A hero is no braver than anyone else. He is simply braver 5 minutes longer. And that's yeah. Joe Ledger right there. He is terrified by what's going on. He's terrified by his gradual loss of control. And the new book, Relentless, is about him completely out of control. A fourth personality emerges called the Darkness, and it owns his ass. It is a very, very dark and very strange book, and it's a fight, one man's fight for his own soul.
That's a great setup to, let's talk about the new book. On store shelves, July 13th, the latest incarnation of Joe Ledger, and I alluded to earlier that something bad happens to Ledger at the end of Rage. And then you actually kind of continue the story that's happening in Rage all the way through in Relentless. And, some of the same bad guys and of course, Ledger dealing with the same circumstances. But it is a departure from some of the past books, I would say, at least as a casual fan. You know, there's a lot more Ledger as a rogue by himself and not fighting with the team on his side. Tell us a little bit about how you approached it and what made you go that direction and just everything around Relentless.
Well, I wanted to, you know, I've been building Joe toward a loss of control for a while now. And in each book, there's some moments where he experiences things that are shaking his connection to his understanding of the real world. And he's taken losses. A lot of his friends have fallen in the line of battle. I mean, one of the things that splintered his psyche in the first place was his inability to save his teenage girlfriend when they were attacked and she was gang raped. He was unable to do that. And then she ultimately committed suicide. He's still fighting that fight. And then he gets into something where, again, people he loves are taken from him and he can't fight that fight. It's a situation where in that moment, there's nothing he can do but be a witness. And that helplessness fractures him even further. He thinks in the beginning of the book, he thinks he's got his stuff together and they go into a mission. They should never have sent him back out into the field. Technically, right. He should have been retired, but forcing him into retirement would have been a tough one because he'd have gone hunting anyway.
Right.
So Mr. Church has to kind of allow him a little bit of freedom to do what he's doing as long as he doesn't hurt the innocent. But man, it's close. And it's Joe fighting not only his inner demons, but possibly the influence of something else as well.
Right.
And I took a lot of structural risks with it because Joe is not always a sympathetic character in the book.
Mm, right.
I even made some of the victims of what he's doing a bit more sympathetic because when you're reduced down to the terror of your own death, you are no longer good or bad or evil. You're not even your own past. You're just a helpless person in that moment. And Joe's essentially the devil of that moment.
Right.
So there was a lot of risk, but from the people who have been reading the book, you know, advanced readers and reviewers, they seem to have responded to that, it's somewhat of a cathartic moment for all of us who have become invested in Joe's journey.
Not only that, but it's kind of addressing the reality of if there were a person in these situations that had to do these things time and time again and had to deal with the repercussions and the outcomes of them, you are going to look yourself in the mirror, both figuratively and literally, and ask some questions. And, you know, this a lot of this book felt like a Joe just staring in a mirror, and I mean that in a very positive way.
You don't spend your whole life fighting and taking lives and doing these things like this, and then just go, yay, here we go, let's go out and have a picnic. And too many people, or too many characters, are not given their humanity. And I think that's important to be able to see something like this and realize, hey, there is repercussions for these people that do these things. And though they seem like these superheroes, they also have their own demons and PTSD and things like that, that it's something that is overlooked in most cases.
It is. And it's interesting. In the early James Bond novels, he had a lot of PTSD and a lot of emotional trauma. And then eventually it just became a rinse and repeat, bad guy, kill the bad guy, move on, which is not realistic. And by the way, going back to another question, which I didn't fully answer about the shifting from first and third point of view.
Yeah.
The James Bond movies have a lot to do with my choice about doing that, too, because in the James Bond movies, you really want to know what a bad guy is doing, what they're doing. And for some reason, since an assassin, which is what Bond is, or a special operator, which is what Joe is, the odds of them ever sitting down to have a tell-all conversation is one in a trillion. So in the Bond movies, they always have Dr. No or someone sit them down over coffee, explain everything to them, then try to kill them.
And, now just wait in this room.
Yeah, it's just hokey. So I wanted to use third-person narration from an omniscient point of view, which is a storytelling point of view where you know everything about what's going on inside the heads of the characters, to be able to tell the backstories of the villains and some of the supporting characters so that we have a more complete idea of why the villain's worldview is what it is, so that they're not a cardboard cutout villain, but somebody who they truly believe this is what they should be doing, whether it's because of an ideological reason or because they think that, you know, they're so either sociopathic or just corrupt that they believe that it is okay for them to do this because they have the power to do it. But we want to know why.
Well, that's the hardest thing, I think, for so many people to do is to flesh out a villain that doesn't just come off as rudimentary evil, and giving them the reason that they truly believe what they're doing, whether they are fucked up beyond all repair or it for whatever their life reasons are. That's what's so hard to do, is to make you feel almost sympathetic or kind of root for them sometimes.
Yeah, there are some villains I've had that, like the villain in Deep Silence, the last of the Department of Military Sciences book, the Russian villain in that, a lot of people were very sympathetic to him because he believed he was doing what was right for his country. So he was a patriot of his country.
What wasn't just a monster. The perfect example is a villain turned good guy toys. He became so sympathetic, we actually root for him as a good guy now. He's playing with Mr. Church, and Mr. Church made him a member of the family, as it were.
Yeah. He's out in the field now in Relentless and will continue to be in the field as the series goes on. He's not going to be part of
the character.
Yeah, he's not going to be on Joe's team. But Toy is interesting thing with Toy. When I did Patient Zero, he was not in the book. And my editor said, you know what? Your villain, Sebastian Gault, is really interesting, but he's in his own head too much. Give him a Watson to talk to. Give him an Archie Goodwin or some useful sidekick. And I had a name of a character named Toys, kind of a sarcastic, dangerous little character. I had that character in my head for years and didn't know what book he belonged in until that moment. And I brought him back in another book, and the fans just loved that he was on this self-awareness arc that eventually turned into a redemptive arc, even though he doesn't feel he's worthy of redemption.
Okay, so we've spent a lot of time on the books. Let's talk about adaptation of your material. I read that you optioned a few of the books to ABC a while ago, and they didn't wind up producing the pilot, which made me angry to no end when I read that. Is there a future adaptation of Joe Ledger in coming on the small screen or silver screen at any point in the future?
It is currently not under option. It has been optioned a few times, once by ABC, and they had Jeremy Renner and Kate Beckinsale lined up for it, and they decided to do the remake of Charlie's Angels instead.
Oh,
what a wonderful decision.
Yeah. And then another group optioned it, Sony optioned it, but they put together a great pitch. I mean, I love the version of it. It was based on Extinction Machine. They wanted to start kind of in the middle of the series. But the problem was, it was way too expensive for series. Heavy CGI, huge cast. I mean, the book can have all the stuff in it and all the characters, but you can't afford to put all those in a TV series.
Yeah.
And they just priced themselves out. So right now, it's back rights are back with me. A couple people are looking at it, but it's not yet under option. And, you know, I'm still very hopeful.
But we are too.
Rotten Ruin is in development at Alcon Entertainment, my young adult post-apocalyptic series. And Joe Ledger shows up in book 3 through 7 of that series as an older man, 65-year-old man. And I don't know if you knew that or not.
I did not realize that. No, I haven't read Rotten Ruin.
Joe Ledger is in 3 different series. He's in the Joe Ledger series. 15 years later, he is in books 3 and 4 of the Dead of Night series, Dark of Night, Still of Night. And then 14 years after that, he's in the Rotten Ruin series as a 6-something special operator. And other characters from that series, from the Joe Ledger series, do show up in the future.
I love that. When authors create these universes, and I also love it when it's not heavy-handed. Sometimes they're just Easter eggs and nods, and then you get to go online and people are piecing them all together. That's one of the great things I love about reading.
One of the fun origin of that for me is after I had done my first novel, Ghost Road Blues, and it had been up for 2 Stoker Awards for Novel of the Year, which it won. I'm sorry, Best First Novel, which it won, and Novel of the Year, which I lost to Stephen King, which is not a horrible thing to lose to Stephen King.
Not bad company.
And I went up meeting Steve and his wife at the Edgar Awards the following year. And we sat and talked for a while. And he asked me what I was going to write, and I told him it was going to be all over the place. He said, look, kid, do this. Kid, I'm not that much younger than him, like 10 years younger than him. But I'll take it anyway. He said, I really enjoyed bringing characters from one book into another in my series, through the Dark Tower books and elsewhere. And he said, fans love it. If they don't know the other books, it won't affect them at all. And if they do, it's like finding, gold. And he said, you should do that. And I'm like, all right, well, Stephen King wants me to do it. I want to give it a shot.
That's the best part is how you write it. It's not taking away. You're not doing it so it's a way that, I don't know who this is, so I'm completely lost.
Right. That's the trick.
Yeah. Right.
Stephen King, I'm a huge fan too, but his nonfiction book On Writing is one of my favorite books I've ever read. And it's great even if you aren't a writer. There's so much just great advice about how to approach lots of things.
His book on the horror genre called Danse Macabre is the best book on the horror genre. It's amazing.
Oh, wow. I'll have to check that
out. That's brilliant.
The last question on Ledger. We were talking about a potential adaptation at some point, some different options. I know there are some characters that you actually kind of reference. Aunt Sally, you would always say, kind of looks like Whoopi Goldberg. Mm-hmm. When you're writing these characters, do you in your mind picture a specific actor or actress that kind of embodies who you're thinking of?
I do, but with a series that runs as long as Ledger, that actor may change.
Yes.
When I created Joe Ledger, he was either Chris Evans from the Fantastic Four movies, when he played Johnny Storm, which he was great as Johnny Storm, or Ryan Reynolds from Blade 3. I liked the super buff action hero with a sense of humor, But it's changed over the years. In fact, when Joe Ledger appeared in 3 issues of the V-Wars comic book, Charlie Hunnam was being talked about. And so the artist used Charlie Hunnam's face on the covers of those issues.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. I love it. My guess was going to be Chris Hemsworth, but at least I'm in the same
ballpark. That's not far off. Yeah. Yeah.
The only thing about Chris is he's almost more of a bunny than a Joe.
He's kind of like lumbering.
Yeah,
a little.
Well, he's also huge. The guy who I wanted to actually play Joe, play Bunny, there was a show called Jericho. Lasted for a season or two. Was Lenny James, who's now in Fear the Walking Dead, and Brian Byers, I forget his first name, this big farm boy type was one of the characters. And that's why I started calling Bunny Farm Boy, because it reminded me of that actor.
That's great.
Or Kevin Durant from The Strain, someone like
that. Sure. Now there's an actor that I've always thought of as Top. And I had to look him up to get his name. But for some reason, the actor just cemented in my mind. Have you ever heard of the actor D.B. Woodside?
Oh my God. Yeah, of course.
He's
character Robin Wood from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Are you kidding me?
Absolutely.
He's a Lucifer.
I think of a buff version of him as Top. That's what I picked.
Yeah. He would be great. The guy I see for Top is, the guy who played Mac on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Sure.
Though there's a lot of actors I would like to see Top. And also it's funny with Mr. Church. When I first created that character, I had just watched The Cooler with, Alec Baldwin, where he was the villain. And he was a scary villain in that. And I described Church as big and blocky. That's exactly what Alec Baldwin looked like back then.
Yes. I'm so glad you said that, because I literally have written in my notes, Mr. Church, I have no idea.
Well, it's funny because when they were pitching the most recent version of Joe, they were talking about J.K. Simmons as Church. He's you know,
well, he's certainly blocky enough now. Yeah. Gosh, yeah, have you seen the Tomorrow War? Out,
but he'd also, he's just a good actor. My second choice was either what's his name? The guy who played President Palmer in 24, was the star of Unit.
The Allstate guy.
Yeah, totally blank his name. I love him. I love his deep voice, his sense of personal power, you know. He just looks like he's Dennis Haysbert.
Sorry, right? Dennis Haysbert.
That's great. He just seems like the kind of guy that would own any room he's in. My second choice would be Idris Elba.
Idris Elba. I have Idris Elba written.
Yeah, because if you see his performance in Pacific Rim, that's Mr. Church.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, that's awesome. Okay, I got to hit a few more because I'm nerding out here.
Oh, take as much time as you want.
So Rudy Sanchez, Dr. Rudy Sanchez is probably the one that crystallized in my mind the earliest and has not changed. And you'll probably laugh because it's probably completely different than what you were thinking, but I've always imagined him to look like Tony Shalhoub.
Yeah.
Interesting.
The guy from Monk.
Yeah. Interesting. Rudy is Latino. But yeah, I can see Tony Shalhoub.
No, I realize that. But Tony Shalhoub's one of those actors that plays multiple ethnicities,
yeah.
And has in the past. And so, like, I don't know. He's a chameleon.
He has an intercontinental look or whatever you want to call those. Yeah.
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 Well, the guy that again, I'm blanking on the name. I'm so bad with names today. He was in a whole bunch of movies playing Native Americans. He was also he's the fast talking funny guy in Ant-Man series.
Oh, Michael.
Pena.
Michael Pena. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. He's Rudy Sanchez for me.
Okay. Okay. Love it.
But also, I mean, I've had people suggest Benjamin Bratt. I've had people suggest Freddie Prinze Jr. You know, it depends on how old the Joe is, because they're this roughly like 3 or 4 years apart in age.
And that's the thing that it's also, it's almost like, because you've been writing these for over, well over a decade now, it's like, which era of Joe are we looking at? Because obviously age happens. My last one, this is the one that I feel most passionately about, only because it seems like this actor would be absolutely perfect for it. Toys would be a younger, it'd have to be younger. It couldn't be like the, do you know Robert Knepper?
Yeah.
So Robert Knepper, listeners, if you aren't familiar, played Teabag in Prison Break.
See the guy that's that lost his hand in Prison Break?
Yeah. Yes, that's him. Yeah. He's kind of wiry and you know, up to no good, but sarcastic. And I don't know. I just always have imagined him as that.
That's a good, I'll have to rewatch Prison Break. My favorite actor for him is the one who played the foster brother in Orphan Black.
Oh gosh,
I thought he'd be great.
I haven't seen that show in a while, but I remember who you're talking about. I don't know his name.
And by the way, there's a weird Orphan Black connection. I was at a hotel once at a convention, and I suddenly my Twitter kept blowing up because everybody said that I'm on Orphan Black. I'm like, I'm not on Orphan Black. They started sending me screen captures. There was an episode where they go into a comic book store to hide out, and there are posters of V-Wars, the comic book, in the windows, and inside of Rotten Ruin comic book. And the guy in the store says, I guess you're not here for the latest issue of Rotten Ruin. I have no idea why they did that, how they did that.
Someone was a fan. That's awesome.
Yeah, but it was shot in England, too. It's like, holy crap. So that was cool.
That's amazing. Yeah. Well, we have plenty of British listeners, so they can chime in as well. All right. So you mentioned V-Wars. Let's end there. That's a show that you did develop, obviously. Or I'm sorry, material you did develop into a TV show. How was that process? Did you enjoy it? How involved were you? What was that like for you?
Okay. Well, V-Wars started as a shared world anthology where I would write big, like 30,000-40,000 word framing story and invite other writers to write individual field reports. And I did the comic. The company that I did that for, IDW Publishing, had just launched its media arm. So they contractually had the right to go out and sell the show, or shop the show. And it took them several years to find a home for it. And Netflix was a great home for it. Mm-hmm. great casting. When I went up to the table read in Toronto, here it was with all these actors I'd seen in, you know, Orphan Black, V, Bitten, Vampire Diaries, Lost, sitting around a table reading words from something of mine. It was very surreal. I was not involved in the story creation for the show. In fact, I was made executive producer at the very end of the process on request of Ian Somerhalder, the star, because he wanted me to, if we had gotten a second season, he wanted to co-plot it with me. Because as much as we liked the first season, and it was really good first season, it was a little softer in its attack on intolerance and racism than we did in the books. And Ian and I are both very passionate about those issues, you know, sexism, racism, homophobia, all of that, any kind of intolerance, we're against it and we want to fight it. And, V Wars is a story about intolerance. Right. And we had plans for a second season. Unfortunately, even though it launched with huge numbers on Netflix, it, you know, over the next couple of months, COVID happened. And enthusiasm for a dark, downbeat show about a plague was not high on the list. So it did not get its second season.
And so it was passed by the news, which was the same difference.
Yeah, which was scarier. Yeah. However, in about 18 months, the rights come available to Ian again, to Ian and I again. And the two of us and one of our producer friends were hoping to be able to then shop it elsewhere with a reset, not a reboot, but a reset with jumping five some years into the future and seeing the version of Ian's character that's promised in the very last scene of the show, where he's buff and he's now, instead of just a doctor, he's now a fighter in the trenches. That's where we're going to go with it.
Well, that's exciting. Yeah. That's an exciting prospect.
Yeah.
This show will certainly be rooting for that. So as we wrap up here, Jonathan, what's next? What's on the horizon? Obviously, Relentless just came out, but I'm sure you have multiple other irons in the fire.
I do. I've actually got three more books coming out this year. I've got September 1st, I have Empty Graves, a collection of my zombie short stories. Then in, I think it's going to be November. Thank you. And by the way, the introduction is by Ken Faree, who played Peter in Dawn of the Dead.
Oh, yeah.
and a really lovely cover quote by Judy O'Day, who played Barbara in the original Night of the Living Dead. So
coming to get you, Barbara.
And they've become good friends of mine too, which is a lot of fun.
That's great.
The second thing I have coming out later this year is a two-volume set called Joe Ledger's Secret Missions. It's all short stories and novellas of Joe Ledger, from variously published, including some new material, and a little thing called Mr. Church's Day Off, written by Ray Porter, who's my audiobook reader. And
I love Ray Porter. I follow him on Twitter. Yeah. He's great.
You know, he was Darkseid in the Zack Snyder Justice League.
Yeah, and the redo.
Yeah.
And
then the other thing I have coming out this year in December, I co-edited Aliens versus Predator Ultimate Prey, an anthology by Titan Books. I co-edited that with Brian Thomas Schmidt. That'll be out in December. But next year, I've got something really fun coming up. I wrote my very first epic fantasy novel, Kagan the Damned. And big, meaty, epic fantasy, new characters, new world, fits that 50,000 years in the future after our world was completely destroyed and, society has rebuilt itself. You know, they don't even remember us. And I just got a cover quote for that by Michael Moorcock, favorite fantasy writers of all time. And so I'm really jazzed about that. I'll be starting the second book in that series soon. Doing a military science fiction series with Weston Oates, something that I created that I brought him on board to co-author with me, and a bunch of other projects. Plus, I'm editing Weird Tales magazine. My third issue is coming out in months, and my fourth issue will be a sword and sorcery issue. And Mike Moorcock, cover quoted my book. I then asked him if he'd let me have an excerpt of the new Elric novel for that issue, and he gave me one.
Oh, that's awesome.
Oh, cool.
And Neil Gaiman gave me a nice little essay about Michael Moorcock to use in the same issue.
So you're not busy at all. No,
I'm a slacker. I need to get a work ethic going on here.
I have to imagine running around in the back of that brain there, too, is probably another adventure or two for Joe.
Yeah, I've got the next five books outlined in my head and about six short stories I want to write. So Joe is not – I want to keep Joe busy for a long, long time.
That's awesome.
Do we get to keep Ghost for a long, long time? How are you going to reconcile the dog's typical age versus how long the books have been around? How do you think about
that? The 12 years of the current Joe Ledger series is really about 4 years in Joe's life.
I didn't realize.
Yeah, because I don't want the characters aging out. Otherwise, Top would be in his 60s by now.
Yeah, good point.
So it's kind of compressed time. And I play pretty loose with how much time has passed. So Ghost is only about 4 years old now, almost five.
Oh, wonderful.
So if the series does go on for another 10, 12 books, since Ghost had a bunch of puppies with Banshee, I might have one of those step up to be the next one. But I love Ghost too much, and my fans would kill me if I did anything to Ghost. I can tell you one thing. The only promise I will make in this series is Ghost will never die in the series. He may retire, but he will never die.
He gets his MacGuffin shot every few years, so it's fine. We don't have to worry about it.
he's got titanium teeth now.
He does.
So he really can tear the neck out of a bad guy.
And he gets to play with those teeth a lot in Relentless.
Yes, he does. Dear listener, if you haven't had a chance yet, pick up Relentless. It's in stores now. Joe Ledger makes his killer dog blush. So you know he's up to some to no good or good, depending on your perspective, with the bad guys.
Yeah, make sure to check the show notes, because we're going to have links to everything down there so you can guys get versed in everything Ledger and V-Wars and until your heart's content. And then we got more coming out, so how awesome is that?
Well, Jonathan, we can't thank you enough for your time today. You've been overly generous. We don't want to keep you any further, but next time, something else comes, we'd love to have you back and love to talk more shop and talk more zombies and aliens and everything else Fortean and in your world as well.
Well, cool. I've got a couple of projects that, as I mentioned earlier, are under non-disclosure agreement. When I can talk about those, it'd be a great place to maybe make some announcements. Because
we'd love to. Absolutely.
One of them is going to be really, really big, and it's going to be a lot of fun to talk about.
We can't wait for that day. So please keep us in mind. And until then, we are going to keep reading and keep watching everything that that comes out of your world. Thank you so much for the time today.
Thank you. This was fun.
John, I'm so happy you picked Jonathan Mayberry to be on here, because I had not read his books before. Now I'm diving into them and I love them. And usually I just take whatever you say to me as complete and utter trash and I just throw it to the wayside. So shame on me for once is what I'm getting at.
Well, write it down. At least we have a recording of it. He actually admitted it. So you all heard that, listener. No, but in all seriousness, Jonathan was great. It was fun to geek out. If you couldn't tell, I was certainly much more fan than interviewer.
Yeah,
there.
John is a huge fan of former strip club bouncers. If you guys didn't
know. I mean, and he's in the top 10. He's in the top 10. in all seriousness, the books are great. If you haven't read the Ledger series, go out, pick up Patient Zero. That's the first one. You don't have to, start with the first one, but I certainly would advise it. And, man, I'm kind of excited about his open world fantasy book. We've talked about both of our love of fantasy on this show before, and hearing his take on it should be fun.
Well, the guy's just got irons in so many different fires. It's amazing to be able to even keep stuff straight like he does. And V-Wars, like you said, hopefully we're going to be seeing more of that. You know, fingers crossed. He's just an interesting and entertaining type guy. He's kind of like a hero. He used to work at a strip club. He wrote about zombies and vampires. He writes about badasses, and he wrote comics. So
yeah. And oh, by the way, the comics are, Black Panther, Captain America, The Punisher,
I've never heard of those, but they sound fun. So
it is funny. He kind of is the intersection of kind of everything that we talk about on this show, from of course the Fortean topics that we talk about, but also when we get into geek stuff, comic books and horror movies, and like, he's just kind of the nexus of all of that. And what I find intriguing, we didn't really have time to get into this because I was too busy nerding out, but you think about this, Joe Ledger, the first book came out, he said 12 years ago. So that's 2009. He said he's in his 60s. I don't know exactly how old he is, but he's in his 60s. That means his most popular series came out in his 40s. That also means that, you know, even his first books he mentioned were written in the 2000s, I believe.
So what you're saying is there's still time.
Still a chance.
You.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen, but I mean, you can pretend. That's awesome. No.
I mean, I'm 40. I have, if I'm on the Jonathan Mayberry timeline, you guys can expect a New York Times bestseller within the next few years.
Well, John, you and I have been working on Hysteria 51, the book. Literally, I don't think it's going to be called Hysteria 51, the book. But
although it'd be kind of great if it was.
So who knows? Maybe that's what's going to take the world by storm.
That will be our New York Times bestseller.
It better, because I want some more fucking cheddar.
For the cheese muffins.
Well, see that and that right there is the reason that the book will not sell more than 3 copies. That's all I'm saying.
Bullshit, I'm buying 3. I got a table that needs leveling, so I'm in.
Well, Nation, we want to know what you think. We want to know what you thought of the interview. We want to know what you like from Jonathan Mayberry. Also, let us know if you like these interviews with authors. We did Max Brooks. We've done Jonathan. They seem to like coming on the show. So if you like them, we can do more of them. The place to let us know is Hysteria Nation. That is our Facebook discussion group. Go to Facebook.com and search Hysteria Nation.
That's right. Also go to Facebook.com/Hysteria51Pod. That is our regular Facebook page. Also Patreon, Patreon.com/Hysteria51. You can find Up All Nights, Man Blur Hysterias. We're actually recording a new one of those tomorrow. So that's going to be coming out soon. And you can hear John rap, as we've talked about. You can hear all sorts of fun shit. And if you want to hear yourself on the show, 773-669-7277. Again, 773-669-7277. If you forget any of this, hysteria51.com or gofopedia.com.
That's true.
Let us know your thoughts. Let us know if you love the Ledger series, what your favorite book is. Did you watch V-Wars? Tell a friend. Tell an enemy. Tell a friend to tell their enemies. And they tell two friends. And they tell two friends. Pretty soon, John and I are just rich beyond belief, and we're not doing the show anymore. How about that? That's the way this works, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, our shill checks have not come through. I was told in error, so we still actually need our day jobs.
Shill are us. Who would have thought that they were full of shit?
And so until we do hit that New York Times bestseller list, we're going to have to just go ahead and do this.
You got that right. All right, kids. So yeah, make sure you let us know what you liked. Which of his books you like, what you want to hear. If there's any authors you want to hear, let us know. Like John said, the place to do that is Hysteria Nation. With that said, I've been Brent.
I've been John.
He's been Conspiracy Bot.
Stay woke, meet sex.
It was terrible. It was just terrible. I'll never get over it as long as I live.
That's it for another edition of Hysteria 51. John and Brent will be back next week with yet more of the unexplained, the unexplored, and the unheard of. Oh, if it's unheard of, how will they know about it? Anyway, if you want to suggest a topic, give us your thoughts, or just make fun of Conspiracy Bot, that's my favourite. Join us in our Facebook discussion group, Hysteria Nation. Just log on to Facebook and search Hysteria Nation, or you can always tweet us at Hysteria51Pod.
You've been listening to a Fourth Hand Joint.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.